Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Effects. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 10 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 17 of season 10. I've been using Boris Effects products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking with two of the editors of the epic FX Network series, Shogun. With us today are Aika Miyake and Maria Gonzalez. Thomas Kruger also edited the series but was unable to join us. Aika is originally from Japan, where she cut mostly TV spots. Her other work includes Chef's Table BBQ, the documentary Hafu, the Mixed Race Experience in Japan, and additional editing on the feature Black is King. Maria's credits include TV series including The Walking Dead, Counterpart, C, and The Old Man. Before I hop into our discussion with Aika and Maria, a brief thank you to our partner, Boris Effects. I've been using Boris Effects and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris Effects is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris Effects suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optics, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmark. And now, Maria Gonzalez and Aika Miyake discuss editing Shogun. I looked a little bit at both of your IMDb pages to learn a little bit about you and to see you've both edited things other than TV. Is there a difference between editing feature films and TV, or editing documentaries specifically and TV? Do those things work different muscles?
Definitely. I come from a commercial background, and I've edited a feature film documentary back in 2013, but in 2020, I edited Chef's Table. I mainly come from a lot of commercial, like 400s, 500s of like commercials and small like short formats projects. I really feel every project, even within the commercials, is very different. So I'm always, when I start editing something new, I always come with like a fresh mind to find out what's different or what's the same thing that I can apply. But I'm always like open, I come into the project very open-minded. That's like something that I've learned from like a lot of different projects that I've done in the past.
I started short form as well, and I found one of the things that I had to get over was cutting too fast, because you only got 30 seconds or you only got 60 seconds. And when you have minutes and hours, you're like, oh, I can let things breathe. Did you find that you had to adapt to the pace?
The pacing is actually my episode. I feel like I'm a little bit more tighter than what Maria cuts or Thomas cuts. When I watch it, I can tell. So definitely I feel like, oh, like I could have given like a few moments there or a few moments there. My personality is kind of like a mellow and like slow to begin with. I love cutting fast stuff. Like I've done like Nike commercials and athlete commercials. That's like really, really fast cuts. And I enjoy that as well. I feel like my internal clock is a lot more slower. So I didn't really feel too much challenging.
Maria, what about you? I see that you've got a variety of work in your background. Is it a challenge to jump from one kind of format to another, or does it all just feel like editing to you?
You know, I assisted for many years, almost 16 years, spent as an assistant, mostly in feature films. Growing up in those cutting rooms, I definitely wanted to be a featured editor. But the industry around me changed, and the opportunity presented itself in TV. They are different beasts. They both have their plus and minuses. I definitely think in features, or at least the shows I've worked on, where we're generous budgets and generous schedules, you definitely have time to really craft a scene. And you know, sort of sit on some of your work, and we have more time for contemplation, basically, which actually we did have time for it on Shogun because we were on it for 18, 19 months. So it was almost like a feature. But, you know, you're cutting 10 hours of TV, not an hour and a half or a 2 hour feature. So in that sense, sometimes you feel like there's more care taken in a feature film. You also, you know, if it's a VFX heavy show, the shots are turned over while you're still cutting. You get the shots, you adjust cuts to fit the shots. You know, sometimes you discover something in that process. A lot of that is taken away in TV. Turnovers happen after we're done cutting. Sometimes even cuts get adjusted based on the new shots that come in. And that definitely changes the process a bit. But what you get to do in television is really craft a character arc, you know, and a story arc. A lot of it is so condensed in a feature film, where on a series, a mini series or a series, you know, you get to sort of explore that for a much longer period. In that sense, I really love that about TV. And I actually love having colleagues in the cutting room and running things off people and showing cuts, which sometimes, you know, on a feature film, or at least the cutting rooms that I was in, you know, I worked with some really generous editors and they would involve assistants and we would sort of have movie time, watch cut, talk about them. And you don't necessarily always have multiple editors on a show, on a feature film, like you do in a TV cutting room.
Do you like having that collaboration with your fellow editors?
Yes, definitely. I wanted to add something. When I was like a student, I read Walter March's book, like the one that everyone reads.
Blink of an Eye.
Yeah, and then it said something about emotion takes time. And that actually left me marks thinking, how can I craft emotions within the commercial for past like 13, 14 years? And it's very difficult. I've done it, but like it does take time, and I've always felt like, oh, like I wish I can have time to bring them like a deeper emotions. And like editing Shogun was something that I felt like I could finally done it. So yeah. And having Maria as colleague was amazing. I reached out even before the date starts, I think, and we start talking on the phone and we went to a couple coffees, and I respect her edit and like the way she is, like it's really, really, really like amazing to learn and like edit like besides her. And like it was such a such a pleasure to work. Yeah. I know she doesn't like it, but yeah, it just it was a dream come true, because also like in commercial environment, you are on a project for a very short time. And you work with someone for 2 weeks and then you move on to another project, and you're never really able to build working relationship like we did working on Shogun. We were working like almost 18 months together and talking about the same project all the time. And like, it was really, really special.
Thomas was obviously a big part of that too. I really had to lean on both of them because I didn't really have any experience cutting footage in Japanese. So a lot of my cuts were basically instinctual, the timing, and you know, the language that we used inherently adds a lot of pauses in the line delivery. A lot of times we had to cut those short because we're constrained by the amount of time we can be on air. It was also very important to make sure that the flow of the language makes sense to Japanese audiences. Aika was a big help there for me. You know, we did have a Japanese assistant, Masami, on the crew who I could run cunts by, and she would sort of flag things for me. But ultimately, I would always ask Aika to watch the cuts and make sure that things are actually making sense, that are not too tight together, or that some of the pauses are not too long, or whatever it is.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you specifically, because I've cut other languages, mm-hmm. And there is some sense of the rhythm of another language. You get a sense of it, but you do wonder, am I doing this right? Even if you know you've left the right words in, is it culturally the right amount of breath?
There were instances where it's like, oh, it takes so long for them to sort of say that last word. I specifically remember in episode 7, So there was like one word that I know was like left to the next cut, and the director of that episode was was Japanese, and he sort of asked for this long pause, but after he was done with the show and many months later, I remember tightening it just because it just always felt so long. And then when Aika watched it, she's like, no, you have to put the pause back in because it doesn't make sense any other way. And sometimes you just have to trust the ones who know. For the most part, I think, I was even surprised how well my instinct actually worked because so many times, I would watch the episode and it would just be like four or five things maybe in the entire episode that would have to like shift slightly.
Aika, what about you with, I'm assuming that kind of these period dramas, the cultural Japanese-ness of the production is different than modern Japanese. Did you feel like the kind of formality of the culture from the Shogun era meant you had to edit in a certain way, or you needed to have certain rhythms?
I find Japanese, especially like periodic Japanese, to be even more monotone than the current Japanese that we speak. I really intentionally watched out for dragginess because of that nature. Especially, I had like a lot of talking scenes, like Toranaga, Mariko, and Braxton, or like a lot of sit-down dinner scene. I took these scene as kind of like a battle, or always wanted to bring like that intention, like an intensity to the scene. But the language itself is quite monotone sometimes, and it was really challenging to bring just the right amount of meanness or like a strongness. Also, like their presence are very filtered. It's really subtle. So how can we bring these subtle expression into talking scene was like pretty challenging and interesting, but I found language actually very poetic as well. Like a lot of words in the show is very different from what we speak. So Maria and I would joke sometimes, like, Maria, you can use the Japanese that you learned in this show and go to Japan, and you think people are gonna think that you're from like 1600.
And then I'm just like incredibly polite because like the thank you in our show, like the literal translation I think is like, oh, I don't deserve to be in your presence and you bestow such kindness to me.
We use none of those words anymore. Like I will Google the words and like, oh, like that's what it means. When I read the Japanese script, like I was such a in awe of like how beautiful it was. It was kind of a revelation for me to actually look back to my own culture and like find how beautiful my culture is.
I love that point that Aika made about the restraint of Japanese culture, and you can see it in the performances. Did you want, oh, I wish they were more expressive.
Different actors come with different backgrounds. I actually found that some of the actors were so big, and it actually took me a beat to get used to it. And then there are some that are so subtle, which is something I generally respond to more just in my work outside of Shogun. I actually struggled more with some of the big stuff that was happening and trying to sort of find restraint in those performances. And it is actually something that just took some time to get used to. I actually remember a conversation with Aika and Takeshi. Takeshi was the director on episode 7, where the two of them were like, I don't know what's wrong with these Westerners. They have a problem with bulging eyes. And I was like, yeah, I have problems with bulging eyes. But it's just like something that's culturally just very different. I'd say that actually it was more difficult for me to sort of find restraint in some of the performances. I mean, ultimately, I think it all felt very cohesive. And honestly, like after a year on the show, there was like one specific scene in the first episode that we were watching like a year later. And it's like, boy, you remember when we thought that that was like really over the top? And it wasn't. It just took some getting used to.
Aika mentioned the script being in Japanese and how beautiful that was. Was the script also in English so you could understand it?
So originally, the script was actually written in English, and then it was sent out for translation to Japan. And then Eriko, one of our producers, along with Hiroyuki Sanada, our star and executive producer, did a pass on the scripts. And so that was like the sort of final Japanese script. But we did have an English version. We even had a transliterated version. So sort of spelled out how to pronounce the words version of the script that was available to us. So I kind of, depending on the scene, used both.
Did you have captions on the dailies?
Yeah. And initially, the workflow was supposed to be like, oh, we're just going to do scripter and then add translation to the cuts. But it occurred to me that that was not going to work for me. And it really wasn't going to work for the producers or the English speaking directors, because if they want to watch a take, it's like you're going to get lost in the language if you don't have subtitles. So all the subtitles were actually generated in the cutting room.
In the cutting room during dailies or?
During dailies. It was a massive undertaking. Props to all of our assistants. My assistant, Lori, Aika's assistant, Beth, and Thomas's assistant, Brian. But we also had Masami, who was our Japanese speaking assistant, and Nicole. So all of them would sort of tackle the translation and generate subcaps for us. So basically we were working out of sequences because we had subtitles on everything. And that really allowed for me, especially, to sort of take on the project as if it was in English. I mean, it really helped a lot. It was so much work at the front end, but it really did pay off. Because once you're working with producers and directors, they should be able to understand what they're watching.
Aika, I think you edited episode 5. We don't have to talk about the specific scene, but I'm interested in your thoughts on the ideas that I want to ask about, which is, I was watching early on in that episode, the hunting scene. Her husband has come back. I was struck by the choice of size of shot and angle of shot during the conversation about the husband returning. And can you talk to me about when you're watching dailies, when you're putting a scene together like that one, even if it's not that one, how are you choosing shot size and shot angle? What is appealing to you that's saying, that's what I want to use? Or is it always just performance?
I'm influenced from the commercial and music video background, where I get excited when I see something different. Especially in like episode 2, I remember getting that first Toranaga and Braxton meeting scene, and all of the director, Jonathan Van Tulleken, he covered the basic. We have the medium, we have the close-up, we have the wide, but the main character is not in the middle, but it's shifted to the corner of the shot. And I use those angles specifically to kind of turn the conversation, or kind of like a signal the changes of the pacing, and like the conversation narrative is moving somewhere. And I really, really get excited when these shots with intentions in it. And so I will definitely try to be a little more playful with it within the cut, but also always, always the acting and the performance is the center of the scene. So I really, really try to have that in the middle, and then I'll try to play with it.
Maria, you did episode 7?
Yes.
And that was, is that Toranaga?
Toranaga, yeah.
Yeah, Toranaga. So there's a surrender scene there, not to put too fine a point on it. And I want to hear basically the same thing from you. There's lovely uses of unusual camera angles, like overheads. What is driving you story-wise to use an angle that, you know, you could use anything. You could spend the whole thing on medium shots if you wanted to, but
yeah,
you don't.
Right. My approach on this show was very much influenced by my first reading of the script. When I read the pilot, I had to draw a diagram of what was going on. Because there were so many, you know, unfamiliar names, and at times it felt really dense. And that was in the back of my head, a feeling that I had that I didn't want to let go of. My approach in editing was, I didn't want my cut to be in the way of the story. The way, you know, many of the editors I assisted who influenced me heavily, I was always taught story is king. Everything needs to service the story. So I primarily look for performances. And then if the camera angle is great, awesome. If it isn't, you know, I'll move on to something else. That particular scene that you brought up, almost all the characters, you know, on Torunaga's side are in that scene. So it was just imperative to sort of set it up, set up the geography, and do some of those things that are very sort of traditional in editing. I didn't want any sort of confusion midway through the scene, like, where did this person come from? Where was that person sitting? So in a way, I feel like I took a very traditional approach to all of it. We were lucky that, you know, we just had really amazing directors. And I want to say Sam McCurdy was the DP on that episode. He just did some really beautiful work. So we just were able to use some really beautiful shots.
I was struck a lot of times because of the era, right, with no electric light, the beginning of scenes always felt mysterious to me. Like on a profile, mm-hmm. or you're seeing mm-hmm. someone in shadow. I don't know whether you played into that, but I loved that sense of a little bit of what's going on? What's going to happen? You know, who's that person in the shot?
In the shot. Yeah, that's definitely. We had a scene like that in episode 10. Ishido is meeting with the regents and he's in the foreground in sort of a dark room, and in a bright room behind him, out of focus are all the other regents. And it was just such a great way to start the scene. And I think at one point it was even cut out, but we like wanted to bring it back in because it was a very sort of powerful representation of where he was emotionally at the time, which, you know, a lot of the guidance in this show is about the emotional state of our characters. What you get is sort of read between the lines kind of stuff. Our cinematography spoke to that. Definitely our music spoke to that. Yeah, it was a big part of how we navigated through the show.
There were translation scenes where anytime English is trying to be translated to Japanese and Japanese, someone's there talking. How do you determine when someone's translating the words, am I going to be on the translator? Am I going to be on the person who just spoke the words? Or am I going to be on the person? Or is it just like any other editing where you need to be on somebody for an emotional reason?
I would say it's a latter for sure. You will have to set up who's talking, what they're saying. But once you set that up, I would often go to reaction shots of other people listening and what's the effects of those words. Like I find it more interesting seeing those effects than someone just saying something. So, and it always leads to the next thing that needs to happen. So once I establish who's talking, I would experiment going elsewhere.
Often when I'm hearing those translations, I'm wondering whether it will be translated properly, you mm-hmm. know, correctly. For example, I remember somebody saying something kind of derogatory, and I'm like, is she going to translate it with that way, or is she going to soften it? Which, of course, she always softens, right? She always makes it a gentler, more appropriate mm-hmm. answer. And then I would think you play that on the translator, right? Because she's kind of lying. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we were definitely guided by emotion for sure, and sort of where you have to be. And not so much about like the translation. Same thing with the, you know, the subtitles. It took me a minute to be like, you do not read the subtitles, or I have to turn off the subtitles to sort of view a cut and not be guided by it in terms of like, oh, how long does it take me to read this?
Ooh, yeah.
Ultimately, with those subtitles, we spend a lot of time towards the end on the subtitles. It was a whole undertaking, hours and hours of sort of honing down the exact proper translation sessions with Justin and Rachel, our co-creators of the show, as well as Eric O. And every single line was scrutinized in order to make sure that we have the exact meaning behind the line, basically. We changed quite a bit of translation from what we were working with in the cut. Because what we were working with in the cut was, I think, taken out of the script, but then also adjusted by Masami. And then some of her adjustments actually revealed some cool things about the lines. It went through so many translations, but ultimately a lot of care was put into those subtitles.
I find like Mariko's story very similar to my existence as a bilingual person. I don't translate to people, but I do live in this like in-between world, and sometimes someone is saying mean things in Japanese or English and like they don't understand each other. Like I've been in that situation and I'm like, just like, I don't know what to do, you know? But I think Mariko's storyline and personalities, everything is written in a way when she feels more open to Black songs, her translation is more full and like warm, but like when she's trying to pull away from him, she's using these words a little more cold and like standoffish. Like those choices of words that writers put into them, they really, really help the emotional distance from Black Zone and other people as well.
Something Maria mentioned is a topic I love to discuss, which is the process of the edit. A scene or something can leave, you can decide, oh, we're going to discard it, like the Regent's shot, and then it comes back. So can you talk to me a little bit about that kind of thing, about the discussions that go around to say we don't need that, and then the discussions that later come on that say I think we need that back in? People think, oh, it's one and done, but it's never one and done, right? You're always revising.
One of things as a female in Japan struggle is that when you are outspoken or when you are loud, or that's kind of like not very good thing. Like you shouldn't say things out loud, or like no one's gonna say that to you, but like, oh, it's hard to find a boyfriend. It's hard to find a good working environment, or people will quietly disappear out of your life, or you know, things like that. It's really, really, I talk to Japanese women, I think people understand how difficult it is to be not outspoken. One of the notes that I got in 108 one time was that to cut out some of the line that Mariko says, it got me to start thinking about, why do we feel powerful when women are not saying anything? When women are silent, why do we feel she's more powerful? I really wanted to challenge that idea. I took out the line, put it back the line, took out the line, wanted to show how powerful it is when she says something. It's definitive rather than it's more mysterious in the case of one scene in 108 when she says, I'm ready. We experimented many times without it, but at the end, Justin agreed to put it back and I was really, really ecstatic, like really happy. All these years of watching TV shows, it has like a patriotic point of view. It's a genuine feeling to feel that it's powerful when women don't say anything.
That is interesting. And of course, it turns that conversation back on you, because you have to, as a Japanese woman, speak out to your director.
Yes.
So how does that collaboration work when culturally you've kind of been told to hold your tongue, but you know your job as an editor is to bring those ideas to the table and advocate for yourself and your opinion?
I never fit in Japanese society.
Are you a little too outspoken?
I've always told I'm way too outspoken and like too much, I guess. So I really felt like I was in a little box living in Japan. So I moved myself to the States back in 2019, kind of thinking I want to be free and I want to work in an environment where no one questions my ability and I can collaborate. At the same time, I learned like there's a way of saying things. I don't want to be rude and I really stand by my culture in that way. I love trying other people's suggestions as well. So I try and like, okay, let's find what was the best way to tell this story. So I love this type of environment where we can experiment and craft and mold the story together.
And this is why Aika was really a great asset in our cutting room, because we needed the Japanese representative to really speak out and share their thoughts from everything, you know, everything from sound design to character development. And Aika was always very vocal. Also, credit goes to Justin, who really does give people a chance. You know, I think if you look at Aika's resume, she may not have been like the obvious choice for the show, but she was the right choice.
The way that I got this job was through Instagram DM. The post producer, Jamie Miller, she contacted me through Instagram DM, but she found this article when I left back in 2019. One of my friends wrote an article about me on English newspaper. Within it, she wrote like, Aika is fed up with Japanese industry and she's moving to the States, which I was like, I'm not like that. I guess that intrigued Jamie, and she wrote me an Instagram DM, but it was in like requested folders. I never really, like, until that day, like, I never really thought of that requested folder. And like, by like chance, I click on it, I found like hundreds of messages, and like within it, like, I found her message that was sent like a couple days ago or something. I talked to Jamie and I talked to Justin, and within a minute, I really felt like this is the right show to edit, because first of all, like, cutting like footage of Hiroyuki Sanada, like, he's a huge star in Japan, and like, that would be like, I wouldn't dream of doing that. But also, they were looking for someone who have genuine understanding of Japanese culture growing up in Japan, but also who can edit more Western style, because Japanese film industry has very distinctive different style to it. I grew up watching more Hollywood stuff, and like, my mother loved movie, and that's me. I'm that person. So I really felt fortunate that Jamie decided to send a DM on my Instagram.
Like Maria said, you were the right choice. Maria, I wanted to ask you about when the editors that you worked for and the rooms that you've been in, did you learn from them what you should say and when you should say it?
I sort of came into the industry when there was still film in the cutting rooms, not cutting on film, but cutting on Avid, but we still had free film crews for previews and such. The technology wasn't advancing as fast as it does now. So I feel like for years and years, you know, I was in this system where the hierarchy was a very important thing in the cutting room. Speak when you're spoken to, or like, you know, you have to sort of earn your place to sort of have a more creative role on a show is definitely something that you earn along the way. You know, I assisted many great, great editors, but it was really Dana Globerman, who I believe she's been on the show. I assisted her on several shows, who made it possible for me to cut and made me sort of see the potential in moving up as an editor. She's created an environment that allowed me to be creative. You know, you could tell that she really sort of believed in my potential. And she herself came up in cutting rooms, like in Artie Schmidt's cutting room, where assistant involvement is a big part of it. And mentorship is a big part of it, which is, you know, part of what gets lost, especially now, you know, now we're all working hybrid systems or remote systems. So you can't really just bring people into the room and sort of sit with them. And it really is a different feeling when you have somebody sitting behind you watching something. It's different than giving them a call and being like, hey, do you mind checking out this scene? Like, somehow just having that body in the room really changes perspective on things, or at least that's my experience. With Dana, I just was in these rooms, you know, often on some of the Ivan movies and Jason Reitman movies, you know, I was in the room with her taking notes and slowly sort of earning my way into giving notes and somebody whose voice was actually heard.
That's definitely a perspective from the assistant's perspective, but what did you see with Dana, and what do you think Dana saw from Artie of their interaction with the director? How the person sitting in the editor's chair needs to socially interact and collaborate with the director or producers.
You know, a lot of respect is given to the director in TV, to the showrunner. They're somebody who has lived with the show for such a long time. So you have to not only view the footage with their point of view in mind, but sort of really try to figure out their point of view and support it. So a lot of the interactions that I've witnessed with Dana were really always in support of the director's view, trying to work things out. She definitely knew when to speak up and when to fight for things. And sometimes it's just remembering some of the early conversations. It's part of the editor's job to sort of rein back things in and make sure that you're still on track. Things change all the time. You are the person that people want feedback from, and you're trying to sort of keep the show on track.
Aika, any thoughts on that? How you try to politically work with a director or a showrunner?
I always have my opinion in every scenes or every episode or lines or things like that. I also know it doesn't mean my way is the right way. From that point of view, I always welcome different perspective from directors, showrunner, or even my assistant. Like I'll ask sometimes, what do you think? I really love the process of understanding other people's perspective and find the right one. That's one of the most fun thing to do while I'm editing, I think. So that's being said, I really approach the conversation more as a discussion, and I'm always open to trying things. And like for this show, Justin was also filming and also editing, and like he's very, very busy, and I understand the time was really essence to the cuts as well. So as much as I want to have like a long discussion, I do understand like notes has to come in. I would try to chime in if something I feel really, really wrong about things, but it was really more time restricted. Later in the working environment, working remotely, but we had a little bit more time to adjust and discuss.
Obviously, most of this environment had to be constructed through VFX and green screen. Can you talk to me about how you approach during dailies and during early cuts, the amount of effects stuff that you had to deal with and the amount of green screen? Do you have assistants do anything to try to get rid of that? Or let's start with Maria. How do you approach the VFX stuff in the show?
So we didn't really have previs on this show, but obviously there was a lot of green screen. I was lucky enough not to cut episode 3. So I didn't have shots that had to be created from scratch. I mean, I did in the pilot for sure. And these were discussions we had with our supervisor, Michael Clayette, later down the line. I obviously tried to talk to him whenever I could. It was really tough during the shoot. But just sort of to touch base and be like, what are the discussions here? Are you planning on some big shots? For instance, in the storm sequence in the pilot, you know, there are some CG shots of the ship hitting waves and whatnot. I had no previs for that. So how do I even know it's being planned on being created? I would talk to Michael, know when I can sort of slug things out. And then for the green screen, we try to temp things out for as much as we could. We had a robust VFX team. Warren, Tyler, and Kelly were up in Canada. And so they were basically temping stuff for us. But we definitely wanted to have temps. Because for a lot of this, you know, you can't even evaluate it without some sort of temp. Especially once it goes to the studio. You want to have them have a sense of what's going to happen.
Before I move on to Aika, you mentioned slugging stuff out. So I'm assuming you're talking about putting text on the screen for wave hits ship, ship hits wave. Or did you try to do something other than that? Or was it always just text on a screen that was the easiest, fastest thing to do?
I think we just did text on the screen. Unless I could find some sort of stock footage that could pretend to be what we needed. We're dealing with like 17th century Japan.
You don't want to pull something from Deadliest Catch and just...
and just throw them in.
Big wave. No. Aika, what about you? How did you deal with the VFX stuff? And is that stuff you were used to doing with spots?
Yeah, definitely. There's like some spots, just background is all CGI and stuff sometimes. So it doesn't really scare me or anything like that. And the earthquake scene in episode 5, they actually had like a practical, you know, people sliding down, and also the hero Toranaga literally went down the hill. We had those shots. One shot that we couldn't really temp it was just the mountain going down. That was like hard to temp it. So we just had a slag and time it again and again and again. In that scene where the army is, there was like a lake in the real world. So it's really hard to imagine this whole lake is going to be just like the ground and the army, and like rely on a lot of it on our imagination. But like when I watched the final VFX, I was so amazed.
A lot of using your imagination.
Yeah, definitely. Like timing wise, I don't know how else to do it. Like we just need to imagine it to time the shot.
Aika and Maria, thank you so much for being on Art of the Cut. It was a real pleasure talking to both of you, and I hope everybody gets a chance to watch Shogun on Hulu.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you so much.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors for a topic-driven, curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Maria Gonzalez and Aika Miyake for discussing their work on Shogun. Thanks also to our partner, BorisFX. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening, and please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you want a good follow on socials, I'm on Twitter and Instagram as @SteveHallfish.